All right, ladies and gentlemen, Greg Kokel on Stand to Reason. And thanks for tuning in today. Somebody told me the other day, he said, I turned you on last Sunday. And I said, that must have been why I felt the way I felt. Anyway, this is the Marketplace of Ideas, where issues of philosophy and religion are discussed in the open form of talk radio. And we'll be taking your calls in just a bit. 1-800-227-5278 is my number. And in the 714 area code, you can dial direct at 754-4150. Once again, 1-800-227-5278. And here in Southern California, 754-4150. Lines are open there. And in just a bit, we'll be getting to your calls about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. Before then, I've got a buddy on the line who I'm keeping from a very important event, which is, I think, the Super Bowl, which I guess I'm not supposed to mention because some of you might say, oh, my gosh, it's on. But those kinds of things don't matter to us. The friend is Jay Richards, of course, research fellow at Acton Institute. You probably remember Jay Richards from his former relationship with Discovery Institute, made quite a contribution there for a number of years. Author of The Untamed God and co-author of Privileged Planet. And I don't know if I want to say the fortunate or unfortunate participant in a debate last Sunday with Christopher Hitchens, and but glad to talk to you a little bit, Jay. How you doing?
Great, good to be with you, Greg.
What was it like to be sitting across from Mr. Sneer? You know, I mean, a brilliant man who has used his great gifts of language and intellectual capability to spend this part of his life trying to destroy people's confidence in religion, especially Christianity.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, it was an amazing debate, I have to say. It was definitely a unique experience.
Stanford University.
Yeah, Stanford University. It was broadcast by the Church Communications Network and sponsored by, actually, Motive Media, kind of pre-publicity for this documentary called Expelled that's coming out with Ben Stein.
Right.
Yeah, and so Ben Stein was actually the host, and a guy named Michael Cromarty was the moderator, and it was Christopher Hitchens and I basically debating the existence of God, or that was the official purpose of the debate, I should say. He went first, and he is, as Bill Craig, another great Christian apologist, told me, that most rhetorically gifted of all of the new atheists, and I know what he's talking about, because Hitchens, I mean, he really can wax eloquent, but he spent most of his time actually just lambasting Mormons and Muhammad and Christianity and blood sacrifice and all sorts of things. I mean, this kind of rambling tirade against what he takes to be the evils of all possible manifestations of religion. And so that's what he spent his time on, including his opening remarks. I tried to spend my time giving what I thought were sort of seven things that theism explains better than atheism, and tried to avoid sort of engaging in, I think, some of the low blows that he...
Kind of a theological food fight kind
of. Yeah, exactly. I mean, it was funny because he was talking religion, and I think, you know, very much a caricature of religion, and I was trying to talk philosophy and science, so it was sort of an interesting interchange.
Yeah, but he always acts as if he's taking the kind of the in a sense, the rational, reasonable high ground and the scientific high ground in his enterprise. I mean, that's kind of one of his strong suits, or at least the way he plays it.
No, exactly. I mean, he sort of presupposes that he's got science on his side, or sort of the evidence of science on his side. But if you start talking about something like a universe that has a beginning and so needs a cause outside itself, he doesn't actually engage it. At one point, he did say, he actually told me backstage after the debate, he said, I have to admit the fine-tuning argument is troubling. And in fact, he had a conversation with, of course, the great atheist Richard Dawkins, and even Dawkins had said the fine-tuning argument, this idea, you know, that the laws of physics are fine-tuned for complex life, is kind of the most interesting argument he said that the theists have.
Yeah, this is the subject of your sensational book with Guillermo Gonzalez, Privileged Planet. And for those who are not into reading, there is a wonderful DVD by the same title. We offer that at Stand to Reason. And I just, it's a pure pleasure to watch that DVD, because it's one of those things that you can actually show to anyone and not feel uncomfortable or embarrassed that they're watching a Christian movie kind of thing. It's just so exceptionally well done. And that's the kind of stuff you guys have done in the past, and I'm sure that's the kind of information you brought to the debate.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, his expectation, and unfortunately the expectation of a lot of these new atheists, is that any kind of serious Christians, you know, are going to be, I don't know, some kind of hayseeds that don't sort of keep up with the most recent developments in philosophy and theology and science, you know. And
the
matter, you know, it's a completely new set of evidence available now
than
the 19th century. And so he's talking about the design argument, and his most recent references are people like David Hume, as if nothing has happened.
And Paley or something like that.
Yeah.
Like, and that's what amazes me, because this is a man that's on the cutting edge of other other disciplines that he's actually made a significant contribution to, and I think he writes for Vanity Fair. Is that right? Yeah, and so he's an elegant writer. Melinda actually enjoyed his book, God is Not Great.
Yeah,
because of the artistry of his writing. Although he made her so angry by the things that he had to say, and it wasn't just that he disagreed; it's the way he does it.
Yeah,
and you know, when I found out you were debating, especially at Stanford, Hitchens, and he has faced just about everybody in the world, except for Bill Craig, I think. And I think I was really glad to hear that, because I know that you are up to facing a guy like that, not just in terms of your information, your theology, your philosophy, your scientific acumen, bringing it to bear on those kinds of questions. But I thought you're the kind of guy that's you're an easygoing guy in many ways, and I think you would play well to the audience in the face of a guy that makes that his high suit, you know, his Trump suit.
Yeah.
So I was glad to hear that. I was glad it wasn't me, but I knew you'd have your hands full dealing with his style.
Oh, I know. See, it wasn't the traditional form of debate where you expect sort of argument and evidence and reason, you know, if you're arguing with a philosopher. But in many ways, it was much more of a kind of a crapshoot, because I knew that he was going to have the sort of artistry and rhetorical giftedness to be able to carry people emotionally. And so, you know, I finally decided, okay, I'm going to just make a point of pointing out that he's not talking about the subject, and pointing out that he's, you know, attacking me or attacking the questioner from Omaha, Nebraska, you know,
sure,
who sends in an email. But it's a different sort of thing from
the traditional
debate.
It's almost like a soap opera.
Yeah, it is. And, you know, I mean, and he in some ways was playing to the 20 sort of San Francisco atheists that had come out in force, but not to the rest of the audience. So it was in very many ways kind of part of a performance. And so I realized that no matter how good the argument is, it's definitely part performance and part argument.
Well, Jay, this is the kind of thing that troubles me about debates, because, and I'm curious of your opinion on this.
Sure.
I'm glad that you took the opportunity to kind of get on celluloid with this debate so more people can watch it on DVD or whatever. And I know that you acquitted yourself really well. But sometimes I wonder if that kind of forum, where the line is drawn in the sand and you got two different rooting sections, if that really is a good forum to get a profitable discussion about these weighty issues, especially with a guy like Christopher Hitchens, who doesn't, in a certain sense, is not taking the rational argument, for all his characterization that he is the rational side, taking the rational argument seriously, and instead throwing all this mud around.
Well, you know, I mean, I guess I consider it an opportunity. I mean, I think you're certainly right that it's not the best opportunity for sort of presenting a full rational case, you know, for theism or for Christianity. But I was pleased with the way it was framed. It was atheism versus theism, so it wasn't is there a God, where the only question at stake is whether there's a God. He was supposed to try to defend atheism positively. He didn't do it.
Yeah.
I was able to present arguments that I think were cogent and persuasive. So that, and the whole time I thought, okay, who's my audience here? It's not Christopher Hitchens. It's not the atheists, frankly, from San Francisco, which are probably unpersuadable. It's Christians that are weak in their faith and need to be encouraged. And then it's those people that are right on the edge, but they're truth seekers and are open to the argument. And I feel like that you've made a good argument if you reach that kind of person, you know, whatever else Christopher Hitchens might do, and whatever, you know, frankly, blasphemous things he might say in the proceedings.
Yeah, I guess, and there were many of those, as I understand it. You know, if he's trying to persuade people, why? Because I read some emails that you sent out regarding the details, and I'm amazed that he would be so. You know, if he's debates are to persuade, at least ostensibly, why would he be so obscene when so many of the people that he's trying to persuade would be really put off by that style?
Well, that's what I don't really understand, to tell you the
truth.
I
mean, he even used the F word with regards to God in the middle of the debate, as I understand.
Right, and this was being broadcast to hundreds of American and Canadian churches, which, you know, this is even a kind of agnostic, and I heard some of the atheists afterwards, you know, basically frustrated that he hadn't presented a real argument as much as, you know, sort of theatrical performance as he had given. But I really don't understand it, and frankly, I think it's like the epistemic effects of sin, so that he's not thinking clearly about how to be persuasive. He's just, I mean, it's not that he doesn't believe in God. It's it's that he truly hates God, and he admits that. Mm-hmm. He says, I'm an anti-theist. I'm opposed to the very idea of God in every way. It's not that he says, well, it's helpful for morality, but mm-hmm. it's a fiction. He truly thinks religion in all its manifestations is evil. And if you point out some Christian that's done something good, he says, well, that's because they were really a humanist. They weren't religious, mm-hmm.
Yeah. I think it occurred to me there's maybe a kind of a dark consistency in this if you're really jaundiced about these kinds of things. Mm-hmm. I've always wondered, why do atheists, materialists, argue so vociferously about their view as if they have a great cause and they're trying to enlighten the world?
Right.
Because I can't understand what would be a legitimate motivation that would follow from materialism.
If
there's no meaning and there's no value transcendently, if there's no ultimate morality, then mm-hmm. what's the point of whether people are ignorant or not, or who cares if people are deceived by this kind of thing? Where does the sense of mission come from?
I know.
And it's almost like he's saying, I'm just doing what turns me on. I hate religion, and so I'm going to annoy everybody up here, and if you don't like it, lump it. So that's the kind of dark consistency that maybe there is with a guy like Hitchens.
But you want to know what's funny about Christopher Hitchens? Unlike a lot of sort of philosophical materialists, Christopher Hitchens is a moral realist.
Yes, that really blows my mind.
Yeah, he says, look, I don't need religion to tell me that murder is wrong or that torture is wrong or that lying and stealing is wrong. I know that. I've always known that. And so, and of course, we as Christians believe that, as Paul said in Romans, that though the Gentiles didn't have the law, they had the law written on their hearts, that there's this natural law that, people have some moral knowledge,
mm-hmm.
Even because of the fall, and even if they haven't had the claims of the gospel presented to them. Of course, sin, sort of diminishes that capacity. But that's I actually decided to argue. My first argument, it wasn't that atheists will be bad and theists will be good.
Right.
It was that atheists and Christians and everyone in the room knows perfectly well that it's wrong to torture children for the fun of it.
Mm-hmm.
The question is, what is a moral fact, and in what worldview does it make the most sense?
Yes.
Materialism, moral facts, is just very strange. Whereas mm-hmm. In theism, you have an eternal God, a personal being who is himself goodness and love, and mm-hmm. continually knows that and can command it of us. He never did sort of address that, except to come back and say Christians have done a lot of bad things.
Yeah, right. And of course, that doesn't address your question at all. That Christians do bad things is part of the theology of Christianity.
That's right. I know.
This isn't news to us. But you were in a position to carefully kind of address what philosophers call the grounding problem with morality. And I know that most of the time that Hitchens is challenged on this issue, it's done ineptly by, I think, Christians who don't quite understand the grounding concern.
That's right.
And they say, well, atheists can't be good, which isn't quite the point.
That's not quite the argument. Of course, it's true that if you're raised in a Christian culture, a Christian home, your moral formation is going to be different than if you're not.
Mm-hmm.
But that every argument, in fact, that I saw and I watched a few other previous debates, they had argued it that way, that, mm-hmm. well, there's no basis for your morality, or if you're an atheist, you're not going to be good, or something like that.
That Christians are better morally than
better. Well, that's even though you can maybe empirically verify that, I don't think that's a very good argument.
Mm-hmm.
I think we should concede and accept and embrace the fact that no, in fact, you, Christopher Hitchens, admit you know moral truth, and mm-hmm. There are moral truths. So the only question is, which worldview does it make sense in? We're not going to kind of deductively prove Christianity here,
right.
But we're going to compare hypotheses. Let's treat atheism and theism as two different ways of viewing the world and mm-hmm. say, all these things we know, the universe had a beginning, we know moral truths, we know we're conscious, we experience our freedom. None of these things make sense in this atheistic materialist mm-hmm. world, and they have a sort of hospitable home in theism, so mm-hmm. that I think you reasonably would say if you had the choice between the two, you go in the theistic direction.
Yeah, it's kind of what Francis Schaeffer used to call borrowed capital. Atheists want to live with concepts and enjoy concepts that make no sense in materialistic worldview, as you pointed out, but are completely at home in a Christian worldview. And I actually think that's a very powerful argument, but I don't think a person like Christopher Hitchens is going to countenance it because it's almost like he doesn't feel he has a responsibility to make sense out of his moral realism, which, again, this is one of those odd things with a smart guy like that. In fact, I was stunned by his latest maneuver, and if I read the news item correctly, did you get interrupted in the middle of your presentation?
I did.
By Christopher Hitchens.
I did. He wanted to ask me a question. He asked me, because of course the subject was theism versus atheism.
Right.
It wasn't specific doctrines of Christianity. And it was reported accurately in the Stanford Daily. He said, I want to ask you a question. Do you believe in the virgin birth? And I said, well, of course, this isn't the subject, but yes, I do. And do you believe in a resurrection? And I said, yes, I do. I'm a Christian, of course. And he said, well, I rest my case. And I thought, this is the most bizarre thing.
What case would that be that he's resting?
He thought, well, I rest my case that anyone that would believe that must be irrational. And so I've proved that my opponent here is irrational in believing these crazy things. You don't have to believe anything else he says.
Well, see, this is, to me, a classical example of circular reasoning.
Yeah.
Because the only reason it would be irrational is if, as a matter of fact, miracles don't happen,
right,
and materialism is true, and therefore a scientific model that operates based on materialistic presuppositions is the only way to know anything. But of
right.
course, that's the very thing that's in question in this debate.
That's right, and that's why I didn't care. I had some friends that said, well, why did you let him do that? And I said, who cares? I mean, everybody knows I'm a Christian. Why would I not, you know,
right.
be willing to admit that? And it's completely beside the point. And
mm-hmm.
I said, look, even if I'm a Nazi, you know, and a crazy, I'm making arguments based on public
exactly
evidence
right.
that you can all check out. And so, it, you know, even if I'm crazy, 2 + 2 is still equal 4
uh-huh.
if I say it.
Right.
And so, you know, I felt like, look, it's kind of a cheap shot. And I think, frankly, for smart people at Stanford, they can recognize it's a cheap
well,
shot.
Well, see,
you pointed out.
Good for you. Well, you are very charitable, you know, and two thoughts that I had
mm-hmm.
when he made that comment is that first is that here's Mr. Rational High Ground. He believes in rationality, yet he makes this incredibly sophomoric blunder called circular reasoning or begging
right.
the question. And he advances, and I'm thinking, doesn't he realize what he's doing? And if he does, he's dishonest. If he doesn't, he's not as smart as he thought he was.
Yeah.
First thought. Second thing that bothered me is, even though this is Stanford, there's a whole bunch of people out there that are going to buy this.
Yeah,
they're going to think that this is a good argument. And, you know, it's like you and politicians, when they're running for office, say
right.
things like, I have confidence in the people's ability to make sound decisions. I don't have that confidence, you know, even at Stanford.
No, that's right. But, you know, I do think that, you know, I think there's a thing called common grace. And the truth of the matter is that I think it was the kind of entire package of the debate. And I'm frankly, I want the DVD, the visuals, to be more popular than the audio, because
right.
I think when you see Hitchens' body language, I mean, there's an incredible kind of hostility that comes
mm-hmm.
from it. And frankly, I just thought, I basically had three goals. I didn't want to headbutt him. I wanted to make what I thought were rational and cogent
sure.
arguments, and I wanted to appear to be a reasonable and compassionate and kind Christian
mm-hmm.
in contrast. And
I'm absolutely certain you came across that way, but my suspicion is you were boiling underneath.
I said, I prayed not to headbutt him, because that would have been my natural tendency.
Yeah. Well, I think you're very genial in discussions and everything. And on balance, I think you're easy to get along with, even if you disagree, because you're used to an academic environment where
mm-hmm.
people are collegial, even when they disagree on weighty things.
Yeah.
However, this character is a tough character. And, you know, when I hear the things he says, my blood begins to boil, because I think he's abusing his audience and they don't realize it.
Right.
And, you know, like I think you mentioned in your email, that he just took the tactic of just spewing out dozens of things that you
right.
couldn't possibly answer in one debate.
That's right.
And that would be the kind of thing that it would be intellectually abusive in my mind and would get me angry. And so I'm glad that you were, you know, you kind of, in spite of the toughest challenge there, you were able to keep your cool. And I'm sure that was very persuasive to many people.
Well, you know, there's costs and benefits to any strategy. And I could have tried to chase every rabbit down the rabbit hole that he threw up.
Mm-hmm.
But I finally decided I'm going to take punches and hits on my, you know, forearms. And just kind of accept
mm-hmm.
that, because that's a tried and true debate tactic. Throw 1,000 things up that can't be responded to,
mm-hmm.
and then they'll get you off topic. But
mm-hmm.
I've decided beforehand I wasn't going to do it. And so the result is that you leave some questions unanswered, unfortunately.
So, well, you kind of played a rope-a-dope there on those
yeah.
kinds of things, but then hopefully laid down an argument in a straightforward way that people could follow, and based on science and design and morality and
yeah.
consciousness and those kinds of things. And so it's kind of like whatever a person's interest was, they could pick what argument they thought was most compelling.
Right.
One quick question, and then
sure.
I'll let you get back to your game here,
sure.
your Super Bowl party and your chips and whatever you got there. I actually have two questions.
Yeah.
I wanted to this is real quick. What does Schadenfreude mean?
Oh, Schadenfreude is a German word that can't be translated, but it's essentially taking pleasure at the misfortune of others.
Oh, I see. And that's kind of his style.
You were asked, what do we think the purpose of life is? I said, to glorify God, enjoy him forever. And he said, basically promiscuous sex. I won't say it exactly how he said it.
Okay.
Taking pleasure in the misfortune of others and railing against God.
That's the purpose of life. Okay.
Yeah.
All right, gotcha. Well, that almost doesn't need any comment because that turns out to be practically self. People look at that and say, okay, I'll do that for 10 minutes and then shoot myself in the head.
Yeah.
The other thing is, I know that you had drinks with him afterwards, and so that sounds like a friendly environment. What was the sense? What was the sense of being with him, when the cameras weren't rolling?
He is a very nice person that I would frankly hang out with, and we wanted to hang out. You know, we got some mutual friends. He served me his favorite drink, right afterwards. He said, let's do this again. And it's just these two different people, depending on whether there's an
audience or not.
Unbelievable.
Last thought here. Was there anything that he said that you thought was substantive and worthwhile in terms of a serious objection that needed to be addressed by theists?
Sure. It's a problem of evil, which we know about. And it's different. I always admit, it's a problem. But it's a problem that's kind of actually generated within a Christian worldview.
Exactly
right. And
the Christian
worldview provides the answer to it.
Mm-hmm.
And so you can always give examples of terrible things that happened, and it has emotional force, and there's no use denying that. That's the most powerful thing he's got.
Yeah, one of the, for quick little quotes, I remember something that Bill Craig said about this issue, and because that great British philosopher Bertrand Russell had made the comment famously, what will a theist say when he's kneeling at the bed of a dying child? And I thought that's got great emotive and rhetorical force.
Yeah.
And then Bill Craig's response is, what is the atheist Bertrand Russell going to say when he's kneeling by the bed of a dying child? Tough luck? That's the way it goes? And I think this takes us back to the question that you raised. What worldview has the resources to make the most sense out of the world as we experience it? Both worldviews have to deal with the problem of evil, but the theistic worldview can at least make sense of it on the one hand, and secondly can also provide some redemptive, in principle, some redemption in the midst of evil as well.
Absolutely.
Jay, thank you for taking some time away from your very important party.
Right.
I don't want to say what kind of party it is because
no,
I don't want people
it.
To tune out here.
Yeah, no, it's great being with you, Greg.
Yeah, and I look forward to seeing you again.
All right.
All the best to you, buddy. Bye-bye.
Right.
Jay Richards, currently with the Acton Institute, and a wonderful thinker, PhD in philosophy and theology from Princeton, author of The Privileged Planet. And by the way, at bare minimum, you have to get that DVD. Now, Stand to Reason has it, but you can get it in a lot of different places. It's not like I want to make the profit on this, but I want you to get it one way or another. You can go to str.org or wherever and get Privileged Planet because it is a very, very powerful argument that it swayed, apparently, in private conversation, even Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins admitted was a compelling argument. Okay, your call's coming up after this. I'm Greg Kokel. It's Stand to Reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800-2-REASON. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. Show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Clear Thinking Christianity. I'm Greg Kochel, your host, and it's my goal to give you something worth thinking about every weekend. That was a great talk with Jay Richards. And in January's, of course, and February's, every year we have our Master Series of Christian Thought, also designed to give you something worth thinking about. Tomorrow night, Dr. Fred Sanders. And this is going to be a talk that's going to focus, I think, in a very creative way on a theological question that has to do with the identity of Christ. This talk is called God in a Box, Drawing Proper Boundaries for Orthodoxy. And we'll do a little walk through history here, the 451 A.D. and the Chalcedonian Creed. And Fred's just wonderfully equipped to talk about these things in a way that are compelling and interesting and funny. And he's got a... This is a guy who's a theologian who writes comic books, okay? So you just kind of consider that combination. Comic books about theology for kids, and they're clever. So this is what you're in for tomorrow night. 7 o'clock at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. Go to str.org. You'll get the skinny on that. If you haven't been coming by already, there's a small charge. You want to hear the talk, but it's doable. Is it $7 or something for the night? Oh, $10 for the evening. And this is the fourth, I think, speaker in our series. And number five, a week from tomorrow night, will be yours truly. And I'll be talking about the problem of new atheists. Old arguments, new attitude is the title of the talk. So I hope you can make both of those sessions. Oh, which reminds me, I'm also going to be in Conejo Valley on Wednesday night, every Wednesday night of February, teaching at Living Oaks Church on tactics, a game plan for thoughtful dialogue with non-Christians. That's the title of the new book I'm just now finishing for Zondervan. It'll be out in the fall if I get my manuscript to them quickly. But every Wednesday from 6:45 until 8, I'll be doing the midweek service, and it'll be a training session in tactics. So four Wednesdays in a row, February 6th through the 27th. Again, about a modest fee, $20 for the series, but you also get the tactics workbook that goes with it. So I hope to see you there. That would be Living Oaks Community Church. And if you go to our website, there's more information about the location and all of that as well. Okay, I want to get to the phones and hear your comments and questions. So we don't have people up yet. Oh, we do. Who's first? All right, that would be Burbank, California. And Annette, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, thank you.
How are you?
Fine, how are you?
I'm doing better. It's always fun for me to talk to Jay Richards.
My question is, I was listening to a CD entitled Loving God with Your Mind by Dr. J.P. Moreland.
Yes, uh-huh.
And here he talked about the relationship between truth and certainty, and truth defined as when things are the way one takes them to be.
Right.
And what makes something true is whether things are that way or not.
Correct.
In other words, if thought corresponds to reality.
Very good. Let me say it one more time slowly. You're right on top of it perfectly. Some others may be just a tad behind you. The way I characterize it is reality is the way things are. Belief is the way you think things are,
mm-hmm.
and truth is when you're right. In other words, when you believe, when your beliefs about your reality match up or correspond to
right. The
way the world actually is. Now, how you know that your beliefs match up, that's another enterprise, and this is also where certainty comes into the discussion, but that apparently is part of your question.
Yes. Well, then a question was asked. I think this is a recording of his lecture in regard to the relationship between truth and certainty, and
mm-hmm.
he said there is none. And he went on to say the truth is a metaphysical concept,
right.
while certainty is an epistemological concept, and it's a property of evidence. It's not a function of whether something is true or not, but a function of our grounds for believing it's true.
Yeah.
And that comparing, I mean, truth and certainty are like apples and oranges. Now, I may be comparing apples and oranges here, but I'm just having a hard time reconciling what he said about certainty with what was stated in Hebrews 11:1, the verse about faith, that faith is being sure of what we hope for and certain of what we do not see. I know that the Apologetic Study Bible says it's the reality of what's hoped for and the proof of what's not seen.
Right.
What he's saying is that
the relation, the notion of truth. Okay, and now he's being very precise here about what he means by truth.
Mm-hmm.
Truth is a relation between a claim and the way things actually are. When the claim fits the way things actually are,
okay.
then the claim is true. So you could say there are 575,000 jelly beans in this big giant barrel of jelly beans.
Okay.
And if there are 575,000 jelly beans in there, then your statement is true, even if it's a wild guess.
Okay.
So there is a difference between knowing something to be the case. See, in the case, if you just make a wild guess, obviously you don't know, but your statement is still true.
Mm-hmm.
Okay?
Mm-hmm.
So you don't know that it's true because you don't have any evidence for it. Now, if you counted all the beans yourself and you had a good memory so you can remember the numbers and you weren't getting mixed up, you could say, I know there are 57,252 beans in the box because I counted them themselves. And therefore, I have a very high level of confidence or certainty that my claim that there are this many jelly beans is actually true. The distinction here is, in neither case is your statement more true than in the other case. Both cases, you are just as true because your statement matched reality. But in the second case, you had enough evidence to be certain about it.
Okay.
And so the certainty had to do with your knowledge. It had nothing to do with truth. The truth was the truth regardless, even if you didn't know it. He's making a distinction between knowledge and truth. You can have truth without knowledge, but you can't have knowledge without truth.
Okay.
You have knowledge when you have the proper evidence. And I think what – and – okay, let me add one more word to our equation. I mentioned earlier that reality was the way things were. Belief is when is the way you think things are. Truth is when you're right. And faith, and here I'm distinguishing faith from belief. Faith is when you act on what you believe to be true.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, I could believe that the airplane could take me to Melbourne, Australia, but I don't exercise faith as an action until I get on the plane, and then it takes me there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? So when the writer of Hebrews is talking about faith here, he is talking about faith and two different aspects of it. One is a confident hope, and the other is the active element. In fact, most of the chapter is about the active element because he's talking about people who had a confident hope. That is, even though their belief could have been true in God and whatever, but even if they had, or they could have made statements that were true and not believed those statements or not acted on those statements. The thing that made the difference wasn't the truthfulness of the statement, God exists and he's a rewarder of those who seek him, verse 6 or whatever. The significance of chapter 11 and faith is that people not only understood this, but they believed it in a way that they acted on it. They had reasons to believe it, and they acted on it.
And so by faith, and then the action follows after by faith.
Well, it's not just the action is incorporated in the faith. Faith entails action.
Okay.
And it is grounded in evidence. So because I have reason to believe that the statement God exists and he rewards those who seek him is a true statement. By the way, it's true whether I believe it or not. It is true all by itself because it matches reality. But then when I have the evidence to see that it's true and know that it's true, and then I act on that, then things happen. And so we have a chapter 11 of the great heroes of faith who believed the truth and acted on it. And so it was the action that God honored. And this is why all of these things happened with regards to people, because they lived out their conviction.
Mm-hmm. I am just curious.
Does that make sense? Does that distinction make sense to you? Okay.
I'm just curious. What is faith in the original language? How come NIV says being sure? The Apologetics Bible says, you know, reality of what's hoped for, the proof of what's not seen, and NASB, it's the assurance of things hoped for, the conviction of things
seen. Well, part of that is just, you know, ambiguities in some of the words that makes it, in isolated circumstances, it makes it difficult to maybe find an English word that captures the Hebrew, the meaning of the Greek word. And this is why the best way to get an understanding of this is not just looking at one verse, but looking at a number of different passages that relate to the idea. Now, the word pisteo is the Greek word that is translated alternately believe or faith. And the concept of pisteo is not simply an intellectual acknowledgement that something is so. So I could say God exists and Jesus is the Messiah. And I could say that and believe it's the case, but never trust in it. Pisteo, biblical faith, is something that is born out of knowledge, and then you act upon it. Okay. So our faith is action, but it's grounded. It's not a leap of faith. We know this because of a number of other things the Bible says. It's hinted here that it's not a leap. It's based on it's a hope that is assured. It is not just a blind hope. And we also see in John chapter 20 where John says many other miracles Jesus performed that were not recorded in this book, but I've recorded these miracles in this book in order that you might have active trust, pisteo, belief, faith in Jesus and in trusting him that he's the Son of God and the Messiah, and in trusting him you would have life in his name. So here you have this kind of faith trust enjoined by the writer based on the evidence he's given you and the miracles Jesus worked.
And you take that step because of the evidence that's been presented to you.
Exactly. This is all part of the package is what I'm saying. So there's no biblical justification for the notion of blind faith is what I'm saying.
Okay.
All righty.
I have tremendous respect for Dr. Moreland.
He's wonderful.
The Virtue of Happiness, and we just watched the film version of The Case for Christ, and he was in it. And I appreciate you and your ministry. You're the embodiment of knowledge, wisdom, and character. Thank you very much, sir.
All right. Well, I'm glad to hear that. I appreciate the call. And as she characterized knowledge, wisdom, character, of course, that's the model that we promote as an ambassador. And I'm glad she thinks I'm a good example of that. Okay, got to run to break, and then I'll be back with more of your calls. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code 754-4150 for Clear Thinking Christianity and Stand to Reason.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks, and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org or call 1-800-2-REASON. Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. Careful, intelligent discussion about ethics, values, and religion. Greg Kokel here every Sunday from 3 until 5, giving you a piece of my mind. My congratulations to Forrest Dawkins in Ackley, Iowa. Forrest Dawkins, Ackley, Iowa, winner this week of our Frapper Prize, which I think I already signed the book, Relativism, Feet Firmly Planted in Midair, and it's on the way, or it will be tomorrow, Forrest. And the way this works is if you go to our website at str.org and you punch the icon for radio and podcasts, a map comes up. You can actually indicate that you're a member of our listening community and kind of plant your flag, as it were, and give us a little information about yourself, and then your name goes into the drawing, and every week we draw somebody's name and award them something, and it's usually a relativism book. But, you know, before too long, I look forward to the time when we can be sending out tactics, a game plan for thoughtful dialogue with non-Christians, and God willing, this fall that'll be available. Zondervan is the publisher. I'm very glad to be partnering with them in that. So congratulations, Forrest Dawkins in Ackley. And just a quick word before I go to Chris and Kevin, who are waiting on hold. And we got a whole nother hour ahead of us, 1-800-227-5278. Lines open. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150, lines open there too. So be glad to chat with you shortly. Regarding this whole question about knowledge and truth and belief and faith and certainty, it was an excellent question that allowed us to make some very important distinctions just before the last break. Just a clarification, you know, the concept of certainty, as JP pointed out, is an epistemological concept, but I want you to keep in mind that certainty is largely psychological. Certainty is a feeling. There can be people that are absolutely certain about things that are dead wrong. In fact, the world is filled with them. That's because their certainty isn't properly justified. Some people have certainty for the wrong reasons, because of emotional reasons or prejudicial reasons, or they're bullheaded. I think that one of the reasons that Christopher Hitchens is so certain that God does not exist is because he's bullheaded. And I'm not saying this in a prejudicial way. This is a description based on evidence. The fact that he ignores certain arguments and et cetera, and he just makes kind of personal attacks that are unrelated to rational considerations. There are a lot of people like that. So just because you are so certain you'd bet your life on it, that doesn't mean that it's true. You better make sure you check your reasons. And that's the difference between certainty that is just a mere psychological indulgence, and certainty that is well justified epistemically in terms of establishing the facts of the case and your knowledge of those facts. And that's, I think, the sense that J.P. Moreland was talking about certainty, that it's epistemic. It's about, it's not metaphysical. It's not about the way things are. It's about the way, how you know the way things are. And when you have good reasons for believing things, then that gives you it allows you to enjoy your sense of certainty. If you feel really certain but you don't have good reasons that you can articulate in some sense, it seems to me, then how do you know you're not just fooling yourself? Lots of people are. And by the way, one of the things that I take comfort in, just in this whole discussion about God's existence, is what Jay has written about in Privileged Planet and done his DVD on, along with Guillermo Gonzalez, that the fine-tuning argument regarding the universe is a very powerful one to show that God actually exists. The kind of God that we're talking about, broadly speaking, an intelligent, powerful, material person. And this argument is so powerful that it changed the mind of one of the world's most famous atheists, Anthony Flew. He's a theist now. He's not a Christian, but he is a theist. And it's something that even Richard Dawkins, apparently, and Christopher Hitchens in private are acknowledging is a tough one to deal with. Anyway, just keep that in mind. Back to the phones, and let's go to Chris. Chris in Orange County, welcome to the show.
Hey, Greg. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure enough.
I really appreciate it. I have a question regarding biblical inerrancy, okay. And I have to admit that I'm really not educated regarding this issue or this doctrine, mm-hmm. and so I'm trying to find resources that I can use to help me understand the reason why Orthodox Christians take a stance on biblical inerrancy.
Mm-hmm.
And this came out because a friend of mine, actually he was a guy that I attended one of your lectures with, brought up a very unorthodox view of inerrancy. And to be honest, I don't know where to start.
Mm-hmm. Well, if it's unorthodox, it's not inerrancy. It's just another view of the scripture, but it wouldn't be inerrancy. Inerrancy means that the scripture doesn't err in the things that it affirms, okay, in the facts. That's kind of a simple way of putting it, but it has to be qualified in some way because sometimes the scripture reports what other people say, and what they say isn't true. It's just accurately reporting it, or their misconceptions or something like that. But it's probably best put is that it can't err in things that it affirms. Now, it's grounded in the idea that the Bible is the Word of God. In other words, this is God's own communication to us. And if God can't err in the things that he affirms, then his word can't err either. Now, it seems to me that that is a sound argument, that it is true that God can't err, and therefore his word can't err. And if the Bible is in fact God's word, and I think that can be shown by separate line of argument, then inerrancy in that sense follows. Now, some people want to say, well, we don't believe in inerrancy. We believe in infallibility. And then this is a kind of, a substandard view of it. Maybe that's what your friend believes in. I'll have to wait and see. But I just want to clarify that's what inerrancy actually means. So if he has an unorthodox understanding of inerrancy, he probably doesn't believe in inerrancy. He believes in something else.
Right. And that may be true just because and actually I had a hard time distinguishing those two, infallibility and inerrancy.
Oh, would you like me to clarify?
Actually,
the distinction is clear.
Yeah.
To most people, you think inerrant, infallible, they sound like synonyms, but they're actually terms of art, which means they have very precise definitions within a certain discipline. That discipline is theology. Inerrancy is the view of Scripture that Fuller Seminary holds. It's often called, infallibility is the Fuller Seminary view, and sometimes it's referred to simply as the Fuller view. And their view is simply that when it comes to questions that have to do with faith and morality and, in a sense, religious truth, that the Bible makes no errors. But when it comes to questions of history and science, the Bible could be fallible in that regard. And so so what they want to do is they want to bifurcate the information in the Bible between kind of spiritual truth and other kinds of factual truth, and say that the Bible is not mistaken in the first category, but it could be mistaken in the second. That is, whatever it declares about God and morals and things like that, that's actually sound and reliable. But then when you get to kind of history and science and all that, you know, it's not meant to be factual in those areas. Now, I don't think that's a tenable position for a number of reasons, but I'm just right now just making the distinction between the two views of infallibility and inerrancy. So you can see that inerrancy is a much higher standard.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay.
Go ahead.
Okay. Well, then maybe what I can do is, well, this question I wanted to ask, it kind of comes in two parts. Number one, maybe you can answer this easily and quickly, is how can I educate myself better on these two positions? You know, perhaps resources or even articles that you've written. I've tried to search your website regarding this.
Yeah, I don't know that I've done anything on inerrancy per se, and I'm trying to think.
You've done Do the Facts Really Matter? And that was in terms of trying to affirm a Christian position based on biblical inerrancy or just on Jesus himself. And the historical Jesus.
Yeah. Oh, so. I see. Okay. Yeah. That's a different.
So that was one thing.
Right. We can make the case for Christianity without arguing inerrancy, but
right.
But that's a tactical matter or a strategic
right.
matter. It doesn't mean that in theological issues inerrancy is irrelevant.
Right.
Let me just give you some authors' names and have you pursue B.B. Warfield. Who is long dead, 100 years ago. He wrote a book called, Inerrancy and I've got it, but It's published by Presbyterian and Reformed, I believe, but it's B.B. Warfield, B.B., like the initials,
mm-hmm.
Warfield, W-A-R-V-F-I-E-L-D, and it's called Biblical Inspiration and Inerrancy or something along that line. It's probably the classic work in the issue. So if you look up B.B. Warfield and just look at the titles, you'll find one that's kind of in the ballpark there, and that's it. So that's one. I would check John Warwick Montgomery, because I know he's written on this issue. And, God, I'm trying to think of who has addressed the question of inerrancy itself. Now, it's embarrassing because I know I have a whole two rows of books that address these issues, but I can't think of a specific title right now. Probably a classic resource is written by what's his name? And I realize I'm taking some time here and you have more to say, so if we go to break in a moment, I'll bring you back at the top of the hour. So Norm Geisler, and Geisler and Nix, N-I-X, and it's called The Basic Introduction to the Bible. If you – this any introduction to the Bible or introduction to the New Testament, like a whole volume that's called Intro to the Bible or something, usually they have a whole section on inerrancy, and they give you the reasons, the rationale, and the arguments for it. And you could even Google inerrancy, you know, and see the International Council for Biblical Inerrancy, ICBE. R.C. That's maybe a resource. R.C. Sproul, Sproul, might also be a resource for that.
Right.
So these are all guys that have kind of trafficked in that information and probably done some. And if I looked at my bookcase here later this evening, I probably can give you a bunch of titles, but that's a good place to start.
Okay, great.
Why don't you we'll just carry this as long as we can here, and if we don't finish, we'll pick you up at the top of the hour. That was my short answer, supposedly.
Okay.
What was the longer
question? Okay, so the second part is how to approach my friend's view on inerrancy.
Okay.
I guess, and this all goes back to the very difficult parts of the Bible, especially in the Old Testament. And the most common one is the wiping out of the Amalekites, and this is often used. And I guess he has troubles understanding the nature of a good God as described in the New Testament, and how a good God would command the killing of all the Amalekites. And I've read some articles, actually some very, I think, articulate and well-written articles explaining how this could happen,
mm-hmm.
but yet he still holds objections to that.
Yeah, well, there's a difference between giving a good answer and persuading someone as you're learning. I've actually written a piece, Can God Kill the Innocents or something like that? It's on our website. I think this is a difficult area to deal with. I mean, I acknowledge immediately that this is difficult. I don't know that it bears so much on inerrancy unless one wants to say, if this actually happened because the Bible is inerrant and this is what God said to do, then I can't believe in a God who'd do a thing like that. So maybe the Bible's mistaken at this point, but the rest of it's okay. So that means it's not inerrant. Maybe that's where he's going
with
that.
Well, let me give you actually the crux of it.
Okay.
What he says is that if Jesus Christ was God incarnate, which is something he believes, he's Christian, then we can evaluate based on what he said during his lifetime. We can use that as a yardstick by which we measure other parts of the Bible,
mm-hmm.
as to, you know, if something comes close to that or if it's spot on, then we know that it is something that it can that we can trust and rely on.
Yeah,
when things fall outside of that realm, that's when they get iffy.
Well, here's the problem. Here's the problem with that right away. And John Montgomery wrote a very good article about this issue, arguing for the full inerrancy of the Bible based on Jesus. You see, Jesus quoted the most difficult parts of the Scripture: Jonah and the big fish, Adam and Eve, Sodom and Gomorrah, Noah and the flood. All of these things quoted by Jesus as factual matters. It turns out Jesus is the one that says not one jot or tittle. He's the one who made the argument for the resurrection based on the tense of a verb. I am the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Not I was the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. Jesus had a very, very, very high view of Scripture. And so if Jesus is the guide, and I think that's a good way to go. Montgomery says, look, based on the evidence of history, Jesus rose from the dead. Therefore, he is who he claimed to be God. Therefore, everything he says about the rest of the Scripture is accurate. But Jesus had a very, very high view of Scripture. He thought it was God's word. He quoted Moses. He referred to the book of, you know, the Torah as Moses said or God said, kind of interchangeably. So now you've got a problem if you're going to deal with, you know, retroactively like that. It seems to me that's going to affirm the Old Testament and not somehow bring it into question. No, I think there is. Does that make sense what I've said so far?
Yeah, absolutely.
Okay, I'm going to come back after the top of the hour. I'm going to put you on hold, and we'll come back to this because this is an important issue, the slaughter of the innocents or the alleged innocents, and I'll offer some thoughts on that. It's one that is brought up by the new atheist types, and I want to offer some thoughts. But keep in mind that having a good response isn't always necessarily a persuasive response. It may be good in reason, but it doesn't always persuade people who are frustrated. We'll get to that in a moment in hour number two on Stand to Reason. Stay with us.
Question.
And that's what Stand to Reason is all about, ladies and gentlemen, asking questions, reflecting, talking, discussing, giving each other a piece of our mind so that we can get closer to the truth. I was in Australia a couple of weeks ago, and David Noble was my host, actually, from Summit Ministries. I was there working for him, and he gave a talk, and he said the reason for rationality is so we can increase our stock of true beliefs. God gave us rationality so we can know the difference between truth and error. I think he's right. And this is what we focus on in this show and its application to our life. It's not just an academic pursuit for us, though, because we care about how we live and being a good ambassador. And it's Stand to Reason. That means knowledge, wisdom, and character. All three qualities are part of being a good ambassador. Knowledge, an accurately informed mind, wisdom, an artful method, and character, an attractive manner. I'm going to go right back to the calls. Incidentally, there are lines that are open here for you. So we had some folks on, and then they dropped off. So I'm not going to do opening remarks. I'm going right back to Chris in just a second, right after I give you our numbers. 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code, 754-4150. 1-800-227-5278, and in the 714 area code, 754-4150. Lines open in both areas there. So let's go back to, can we do that? He's there? Chris, can you hear me? No, I got to push the button. Chris?
Yes.
Okay, good. So our discussion, we ended last hour, started out kind of a discussion about inerrancy, but I think it took a little of a turn. And your friend that you're dealing with, and so this isn't just an academic issue, for you, it's a personal issue because you have a friend that is challenging you on the question of whether the Bible is accurate in all that it affirms, that it's inerrant. And part of the concern is a conflict between your friend's high respect for Jesus and his concern about elements in the Old Testament, that genocide, for example, the Amalekites, commanded by God to be wiped out by the Jews, and this just seems hard to stomach morally, and I think the suspicion is by your friend, and correct me if I'm wrong, Chris, that this doesn't sound like Jesus.
Exactly.
And so if it sounds like Jesus, well, this is maybe legitimate, but if it doesn't sound like Jesus, then it's questionable.
Right, exactly.
And so that would be his... that would be his take on inerrancy.
Well, I'm hopeful. If he listened to this, I would hope that's what he would say.
Okay, well, because that, like I said earlier, that's not inerrancy. That would be his take on inspiration. And his view is not inerrancy. His view is limited inspiration. In other words, part of the Old Testament might be true, part of it might not be, but the way we know is we compare it to what Jesus said. Now, there's some interesting problems with this view just right off, and I mentioned the first one, that if we just look at what Jesus said, Jesus himself did not have that view of the Old Testament scriptures. Okay? He quoted from everywhere all the major sections, and he treated it as authoritatively as if it were God's word. And so this already your friend is a little at odds. You also have another problem. How is it that Jesus' statements, Jesus never wrote anything? I mean, what we do have isn't what Jesus wrote. It's what other people wrote about him and about what he said. And our doctrine of inerrancy does not, strictly speaking, apply to Jesus. It applies to the writings of the people who followed him. So how is it, I mean, I think you've got a practical concern here. How can you say, well, I trust as inerrant everything that was written about Jesus by these followers, but I don't trust anything else that was written by the similar kind of people, you know, human beings, unless it's somehow affirmed by the things that people wrote about Jesus. Do you see the point I'm making?
Right, I do.
So I think there's a practical concern there, and I think we have every reason to believe that these men wrote accurately about Jesus and what he said, and I do believe that Jesus' own teaching on earth was God's word because he was God. And so by definition, whenever he speaks, he's speaking the word of God. But strictly speaking, our doctrine of inspiration has to do with the scriptures, that is, the writings about these things. And did God superintend the accuracy of the writings? And so your friend wants to say, well, I'm confident he superintended the accuracy of the writings of Jesus' words, but I'm not confident of the other things. So that, I think, is problematic procedurally. I think it's problematic that even if you take it at face value, Jesus had a higher view of the Old Testament than he did, which puts him at odds with Jesus.
Yeah, perhaps, but it almost seems that some of the things that Jesus did, I guess the New Testament conception of God, it doesn't vary, but yet it is still a lot more loving and forgiving than some of the things that happened in the Old Testament.
Oh, okay. Well, so, this is where, are you saying that this is your conviction, or you think this is what he'd say?
Oh, I think that is what he would say.
Yeah, but he's just not reading closely. He's not reading carefully. The Amalekites were slated for judgment during the time of Joshua, but God was considering judging them over 400 years earlier. And that he was talking in, I think it's in Genesis 15 to Abraham, and he said, look, the iniquity of the Amorites is not complete yet. So he is waiting and waiting, showing mercy to them, okay? When people repented, I'll tell you who is worse than the Amalekites, and that was the Assyrians. Remember Jonah went to the Assyrians, though?
Mm-hmm.
Why was Jonah mad? Because God showed mercy to these absolutely brutal people when they repented. Tremendous mercy to the entire nation. Now, later on, they changed their mind, and so did God. And God judged them, but he also used them to judge Israel when Israel was bad. So you see justice and mercy displayed magnificently all through the Old Testament if you read carefully. And this is why it says in Exodus 20, it says God is a jealous God who will visit the sins of the fathers on the children to the third and fourth generation, but show mercy of those who hate him. There's a qualifier there. In other words, he'll keep punishing those who hate him. Generation after generation, he'll punish those. But he shows mercy to the thousandth generation, to those who love him. Now, the reason he says fourth and fifth generation and third and fourth and thousand generations, it's a literary device to compare his mercy to his judgment. He is much quicker to show mercy than he is to judge. And we have many examples of this in the Hebrew Scriptures, but in the New Testament, if you look at the teachings of Jesus and what Jesus promises, it does not look pretty. There are two comings that Jesus talks about. First, he's coming not to judge, but to offer mercy. God always offers mercy first. If mercy is disregarded, God brings judgment, and it will be at Jesus' own hand. According to his own words, he will be the one that will come back and judge people and will execute judgment. And there he is in Matthew 25, separating the sheep from the goats and casting the goats into a fiery hell that has no end.
Greg, I don't think he would have as much difficulty with that. We had a huge discussion about that, and I don't think his difficulty is with grown human beings who can make decisions on whether or not to accept God's mercy, but rather the innocent children that were, when they went out to kill the Amalekites, it was everybody.
Right. Yes.
And I think that is the difficulty.
Yeah, I can see that. And so how does he feel about the flood?
He would probably say the same thing too.
Okay, he'd have to say that.
I didn't ask him about
okay.
that one.
He would have to say the same thing about the second coming because the same thing happens. So I think this is a legitimate concern, and this is where I think, and even myself personally, we have to get more. I think we have to get better at answering this question. But I do speak about this issue in one of my articles, and I say, you know, I try to first make the problem worse. They say, well, the Canaanites, Amalekites, and Amorites, that's a drop in the bucket compared to the whole world in the flood and a much more populous world at the second coming, because there you have global judgments in both cases. Now, here's the question, and I think this is the root question. Does the maker of the world have as a legitimate liberty to destroy what he makes when he wants to?
Well, he would say yes. And I think I would say yes, too.
Okay, then
but whether or not it's necessary to do that.
Well, necessary is irrelevant to the question, because if he has the liberty to destroy when he wants to, as long as he wants to, whatever his reason might be, I'm not saying that God is doing these kinds of things frivolously, but I'm saying even if we don't know the reason, isn't it fair for us to say, I don't know the reason, all of the reasons, but doesn't he have the right to do with what he created, whatever he wants? He's going to destroy he's going to burn up the whole earth and the universe, I mean, to a crisp and make a whole new one. No one complains about that. That's 2 Peter 3. The human beings go with it. Does the creator of the universe have the right to take life and give life? I think he does. And I don't think he needs to justify it to anyone. Again, I'm not saying his reasons aren't morally adequate, but I'm just simply saying that seems to be within his province. So if he decides that he is going to kind of obliterate the human race and kind of start over with eight people of the flood, well, he's within his rights to do that. It isn't like you and I are trying to kill everybody. Now, whether God decides to wipe out a group of people by a flood or by incineration or something, or by using other people to do it, like the Jews in the case of the Amorites or Amalekites, to me that's an incidental kind of detail, because God can choose the means of his judgment any way he wants. And so I think the core question is, does he have the right to do this? Now, I think that is a good answer. Rationally, I do not think that is a satisfying answer emotionally for most people.
Right.
But
right. I think I remember reading something that you wrote that basically had that same explanation.
Right.
That it wasn't emotionally satisfying.
Now, some people have said, by the way, that there's evidence that with people like the Amalekites, there was so much radical sex with animals and incest and all that other, that people were completely infected, including children and beasts, with these venereal diseases, that they had to eradicate all of them so that they didn't affect the Jews. I'm not sure what the bib source is for that, but I've heard that a number of times, so there may be some legitimacy to that. The point is, there may be some factors that we're not completely aware of that would cast this kind of action in a different light if we knew the details. We don't know the details. We have to ask ourselves the question, is God the kind of God that would do right even in a circumstance like that? Can we trust him to do right? Is he within his rights to do that? Is it wrong for him to destroy something he created? So I don't think it is wrong for him to do that. And if it's not wrong for him to destroy what he created, then it can't be wrong for him to destroy the Amalekites, man, woman, and child.
Right. And the only reason why I pause is that then goes into another discussion.
Okay, I know. Look, I've said before that all these kinds of things are not tidy.
Yeah.
All right? And also, I think we have to be careful that we don't try to sanitize God. We don't try to clean him up and make him look tidy when maybe it's not legitimate for us to do so. I mean, I think there are some misunderstandings about things that God has done. But there are other times, you know, God is just kind of a scary being, you know? That's why they talk about the fear of the Lord. They're not just talking about, let's just nod our heads and tip our hats to him. There's kind of like a little bit of a trembling going on in that fear. And I think there's good reason for it. If you read in the Hebrew Scriptures and in different parts of the New Testament, particularly in the Book of Revelation, you see more of this. You see this evident, this coming out. And so we are to be in awe of God because, after all, He is the sovereign. That's what it means to be the Lord. He is the legitimate sovereign over the universe, and He can do whatever He wants. And now I'm trusting that what He wants is going to be good. And so, and it seems to me that if He creates something, He can destroy it. He has no further obligation that way. So if he sees fit, in a sense, to destroy the Amalekites, every man, woman, and child, I think there's a reasonableness to this, although we are very sensitive to that in our culture, in our way, and because, you know, that sounds icky and untidy. I just think we ought to be careful that we don't try to over-sanitize Him.
Yeah, no, I agree. I think that makes a lot of sense.
I think you can say to your friend, you know, you say, Kokel and I talked about this, and we're both uncomfortable after a fashion with this, although there might be kind of a kind of an argument that helps out. It still makes us feel kind of icky. But what we can't do is we can't just, like, say, I don't like that, so I'm just not going to believe it. Because look, you like Jesus, right, your friend? You like Jesus, and Jesus affirmed all these books where these things show up, and Jesus does some nasty work Himself later on. So if Jesus is our guide, I think we still can justify inerrancy, even with the nasty stuff or the stuff that we don't like. All righty?
Well, yeah, thank you very much, Greg. I appreciate your time.
Yeah, you're very welcome, and I appreciate your question, and hang in there with your buddy.
All right, thanks a lot.
Yeah, all the best to you. I appreciate the attitude. I just spent a lot of time on that because there's so many things that are going on in that, not just the issues themselves, but some of the ideas driving the issues, like I just mentioned. It's not always going to be tidy, and we got to be careful we don't sanitize God in trying to answer some of these challenges. All right, that was Chris. Let's go to Kevin in Denver. And Kevin, you've been waiting. Thanks for your patience.
Hi, Greg. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
I heard you say that one should marry wise, marry well.
Uh-huh.
And I wonder what you mean by that.
Well, that would be like marry as in matrimony. And this was a bit of wisdom given to me by my former pastor, Zach Nazarian, and I think it was sound, and this is why I've repeated it. It's kind of a teaching technique called an aphorism, where you say something in a clever way, and in this case, it's kind of the same thing is repeated in a little different way. You see something similar in the scriptures. You know, they say the same thing twice in a little different way, and it's just meant for emphasis. So he says, when he says marry wise, he means marry well. When he says marry well, he means marry wise. The point here is that it's grounded in the conviction that marriage is a one-way ticket.
Okay.
There's no round trip. You don't got a return ticket kind of hidden in the bag there just in case you don't like the destination. You're moving to this place for good, and you're burning your bridges.
Right.
Now, if you understand that, if you have a sober understanding about that initially going into it, you are going to be more careful about the choice that you make, since you have to live with this decision for the rest of your life. Be smart. Make this a good decision and choose the person you're choosing for the kinds of reasons that will encourage a long-term a healthy, satisfying, long-term relationship. Not the kind of things that are going to that just turn you on in the moment. And this is
right.
The way, you know, movies are notorious about this. You know, people get married, fall in love overnight, and it's all the wrong kinds of reasons. And it's understandable why people would react that way, but this, did we just lose you? I think we just lost Kevin. Oh, I'm sorry. I just heard it go. I didn't touch nothing. All right. So, Kevin, you can't still hear me because you're in Denver, unless you call back. But certainly you can catch the podcast. Since this is such an important decision, then we have to make sure that we are making the decision based on reasons that secure a long-term stable relationship. I guess that's the point. So when he says marry well and marry wisely, he's saying be careful who you choose. If you had to choose a roommate, I mean, those of you who are single, a lot of you are living with people, right? I mean, like roommates of the same sex is what I mean. Some aren't, but you get my point. You got a a roommate you choose. Now, what if you sometimes that goes well and sometimes it doesn't. I've had gazillions of roommates in my past, and before I finally got married at almost 48 years old, and I own a four-bedroom house, so I got a lot of guys helping me with the rent. But some were great and some were absolutely awful. Now, I always had the the liberty of knowing if it didn't turn out, I can throw them out. And one person I did throw out. If you know, though, whoever you choose as a roommate, you cannot throw out, do you think you'd be much more careful? Yes, I think. And that's exactly what you're looking at. Now, my wife is the best roommate I've ever had. But part of this relationship is it's not catch and release anymore. She's a permanent resident in my life. And consequently, I was very careful in making the decision. I followed my pastor's advice, and I made a really good decision. But not everybody does that. And so his persistent counsel, marry wise, marry well, to the congregation was something that had a big impact on me. And so I pass it on. I think it's sound for those reasons. Kevin, sorry we lost you, but time for break? Okay, we'll go to break, and then we'll be back to your calls. 1-800-227-5278 in the 714 area code 754-4154. Stand to reason.
In 1859, Charles Darwin published On the Origin of the Species and argued that all of life on Earth was the product of time, chance, and natural selection. However, contemporary scientists are advancing a powerful but controversial idea, the theory of intelligent design. Using state-of-the-art computer animation, the Unlocking the Mystery of Life DVD transports you into the interior of the living cell to explore systems that bear the unmistakable hallmarks of design. This compelling documentary examines an idea with the power to revolutionize our understanding of life and to unlock the mystery of its origin. Unlocking the Mystery of Life. To order this riveting DVD, call 1-800-2-REASON or go to our website, str.org. That's 1-800-2-REASON or str.org.
Friends, in 2 Corinthians, Paul calls every Christian an ambassador for Christ. And that's why Stand to Reason was founded. That's why we continue. And now our commitment to helping you grow in what we call the foundations of an ambassador, knowledge, wisdom, and character, has just gotten easier. Our new ABC Studies, that's Ambassador Basic Curriculum, gives you important information on presenting and defending your faith. In these three self-directed studies, we'll cover the groundwork of how you can be an agent of change for Christ. That includes tactics in defending your faith and in-depth information on sensitive topics like abortion, homosexuality, religious pluralism, relativism, and evolution. The ABC studies are designed with busy people in mind, so you'll see maximum results in minimum time. You'll be amazed how quickly you'll be ready to take a stand as a follower of Christ. We'll even certify you as an ambassador when you're finished. Now, to find out more about the ABCs, the Ambassador Basic Curriculum, call us today, 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. That's 1-800-2-REASON, or visit on the web at str.org. The show is Stand to Reason, ladies and gentlemen. I'm Greg Kokel, the host. Gosh, can you believe it's February? He said December. He's wrong. It's February already. Boy, that is fast. This is 2008, and it's already the second month. Well, that means summer is not too far away. You think it might be, but it's closer than you think. And our cruise coming up August 2nd through 9th. Boy, this is going to be so much fun. Of course, you know all about it. We've talked about it. J.P. Moreland, of course, will be on the cruise. Josh McDowell will be there with his son, Sean McDowell. All three will be faculty for our cruise going to Alaska. And our ports are Juneau, Skagway. Of course, we're going to Glacier Bay National Park. That's not a port. We don't get off, but we spin around there in that wonderful bay for hours and hours looking at calving glaciers. That's when they kind of break off and crash boom, and it's just magnificent. We'll be in Ketchikan. We'll be leaving from Vancouver, British Columbia, so you can come a couple days early. You can stay a couple days late and kind of visit that wonderful city up there in British Columbia. It's just going to be a sensational time, all of us together, learning, enjoying each other's company on this Alaska cruise. Now, the Enforcer has put up some stuff on our homepage at str.org where you can get more information. That includes our interview with J.P. Moreland last week. Was it last week on the cruise? And plus a photo album on our homepage, a link there on the homepage of the last cruise that we did the year before last. So you can kind of get the firsthand deal. And I think all of these photos, these are not like postcards or something. These are all photos the Enforcer took herself. Is that right? Did you take these photos? Are there any of Annabeth there at 6 months? There are one at 6 months old. She's just turned three. Anyway, we hope you can join us. Now's the time to start planning for August 2nd through 9th, Stand to Reason Alaska Cruise 2008. Let's go back to the phones. And Linda in El Cajon, that's down San Diego County. Welcome to the show, Linda.
Thank you. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
My question is, or my difficult thing is, I have these Jehovah's Witnesses coming over to my house.
Mm-hmm.
And I've witnessed to them about the Trinity, mm-hmm. and we talk about different things. And I'm saying things I know they don't believe, and they still want to come back.
Mm-hmm. Well, I suspect they think that they're going to wear you down. That's my suspicion, Linda. They are. In my experience, I haven't had a lot of experience with Jehovah's Witnesses. And,
I haven't had any in a long time.
Yeah.
All of a sudden.
But I will say this: I have had some encounters, and the few encounters I've had is that when they generally, or at least with me, when they it's almost as if when they encounter somebody who have some spiritual depth and biblical knowledge, they turn on their heel and they head down the street for easier game.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's just me, the way I came across to them or what, but and they always come in pairs, of course,
yeah.
and I think that they think that they might just wear you down.
Hmm.
Now, that might be part of it. You sound like a very nice person.
Oh, well, thank you.
And they might enjoy your company.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you something about – see, they go door-to-door witnessing, right? This
yeah.
is part of their – this is a guess here, but I used to be involved in summer outreach projects, two of them in Hawaii and one of them here in Southern California. That when I was a fairly new Christian, it was part of the Jesus Movement, a kind of enterprise, and so is the late 70s. I did notice something. We had training during the evening at different times, and then we would have these outreaches where we would go out on the beach and witness to people in Waikiki or in Hermosa Beach here in the mainland or whatever. And, you know, it's interesting. People who here were all these students that really wanted to share their faith, but when it got time to actually doing it, all of a sudden they had to have these heavy conversations with their witnessing partner about problems they were having in their life. And in other words, they were looking for any excuse not to go out. So there's a psychological element here that it's difficult to confront people about these issues. And I would not be the least bit surprised that this is the kind of thing that goes on with door-to-door cult evangelists like Jehovah's Witness folks, that they've got to do this because their salvation essentially depends on it. And so if they find somebody who's a nice person to talk to about theological matters, they're happy to keep going back there and just sitting in the living room drinking tea and eating crumpets while they talk about theology, as long as you'll let them, because that means they don't have to keep pounding on doors. This might be a psychological thing going on there. It's just, like I said, a guess. But have you ever had conversations with them with another person with you in conversation with those two?
Another Christian?
Yes, uh-huh.
No, I haven't.
Because they go out in twos for a reason. You know,
yeah.
It's easier. And what you might want to consider is if they want to continue meeting with you and you want to continue meeting with them, then you may want to consider having someone else with you
mm-hmm.
that could, you know, you have more of a tag team
mm-hmm.
instead of being two against one. I don't
yeah.
know. Are you feeling overwhelmed by them?
I'm not overwhelmed. I just tell them the truth, and they just – I figure if I tell them all this truth and say, look at me – And they still want to come back. I said, you don't want to come back and see me, I know.
Hmm.
He said, no, no, we want to see you.
Hmm. Well, I'm not sure exactly what to do in that case. I think it might be there might be this other thing going on, like it's easier for them to talk to you and than to bang on doors. But I don't know if they get extra credit for longer conversations. I don't know how that works in the JW system. But in any event, I'd encourage you having somebody else there. And I also want to encourage you, there is an argument that you can offer them that has to do with a central issue. Jehovah's Witnesses have a lot of different beliefs from Christians, and they don't believe in birthdays and Christmas trees and all that kind of stuff.
I know pretty much about them, but I don't know.
Well, what I was going to say is I encourage people not to get kind of lost in details that aren't quite as critical, okay? And I don't think birthdays are worth fighting over.
No.
But certainly justification, how we are saved, how we become accepted by God, that's one issue. And another issue is the person of Jesus. And these are worth discussing.
Yeah.
So there are two things with regards to how you become accepted by God. What is it that gives you access to God? I asked this question, and you might just jot this down.
I'm recording it too.
Oh, okay, super. The question is, can I be right with God if I am not a member of your organization?
Oh, yeah.
Now, the answer to that is no. That's the correct answer from them. But they will. But I think when you say it quite like that, then it sounds a little odd. And so the times I've asked it, people have hemmed and hawed, but that's what it amounts to. And so that's when I say, well, show me where, anywhere in your Bible, where there's any indication that I have to be a member of any organization, especially yours that was founded, you know, in the just less than 100 years ago, in order to be accepted by God, in order to be in the kingdom. Now, they're not going to be able to do that. See, they promote an organization for salvation. They don't promote Jesus. So that's the first question that I would suggest. And maybe this will make the time together a little more interesting.
Well, it's been interesting.
Okay, well, that's something that you could address. Second thing is there is an I can't go over the whole thing right now, but I want to direct you to our website at STR to another argument about the deity of Christ. And this is an argument that you can make even from their, I think, a purposefully corrupted translation called the New World Translation.
Yeah.
And a lot of times there's a fuss between whose view is right. Well, this is an argument you can make even with their translation. And it's based on the argument is that Jesus is God because he is the uncreated creator.
Yeah, I've told them that.
Yeah, well, this comes from chapter 1 of John in the third verse. Through him all things were made, and apart from him nothing. Came into being through him, and apart from him nothing came into being that has come into being. Okay. Now, you can even use our translation to make this argument. I can't make it for you right now because it involves drawing a couple of squares on a piece of paper to make the point carefully. So if you go to our website at str.org and then you search for the article.
The number is STR.
You know, here, I'll tell you what. If you call our office during the week, then somebody will print out this article for you and mail it to you.
Okay, that would
all right.
Be great.
The article is called Deity of Christ, Case Closed.
Mm-hmm.
Deity of Christ, Case Closed.
Appreciate that.
Yeah, and so just call 1-800, the number 2 in the word reason, and it's toll free, and just call during regular business hours.
What is it? It's STR?
It's 1-800.
1-800.
The number 2.
Number 2.
And then the word reason, R-E-A-S-O-N.
So the 2 is a natural numeral?
Correct.
Okay.
Yeah.
1-800-2-REASON.
That's correct. And then just say that Greg promised that they'd copy this and mail it to you. So it's called The Deity of Christ, Case Closed, and they'll run out a copy and just put it in the mail to you.
Okay. I appreciate it.
Okay, Linda.
That.
I appreciate your call.
Okay.
All the best to you, dear.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Deity of Christ, Case Closed. It's available on the website, easy to find, and it is an irrefutable argument, textual argument, in favor of the deity of Christ. In other words, it's based on the Bible's own statement. And when you, in a sense, position it or state it the way that I direct you in the article, using a little illustration, a couple of boxes, there's no way out of it. And it just is one of many, many, many places in the Scriptures where the Scriptures declare the deity of Christ, the full deity of Jesus, that he is the Jehovah God of the Old Testament. Now, I realize it raises other questions, but the first question is a scriptural one. What does the Scripture actually say? Incidentally, if you're interested in this whole idea, and you ought to be if you're a Christian, when we do our Master Series of Christian Thought, a lot of our things are the series of lectures that we do in January and February, a lot of our lectures are dealing with defenses for the faith, in a sense. I'll be lecturing a week from tomorrow night, for example, in Hermosa Beach at Hope Chapel, talking about the new atheists, and so giving some lines of reasoning and arguments and how to deal with that challenge, people like Christopher Hitchens and Richard Dawkins and Daniel Dennett, etc. But tomorrow night, Dr. Fred Sanders is going to be doing a talk that's more theological in nature, not any less important, just in a different direction. It's more, what does the Bible teach? What is orthodoxy? And specifically, he's going to be talking about who Jesus is. This talk is called God in a Box, Drawing Proper Boundaries for Orthodoxy. And he's great because he does theology with cartoons, and he writes comic books, theological comic books for kids. And this, of course, he works all into his presentation and into his PowerPoint. And you really enjoy it. I hope you can make it by tomorrow at 7 o'clock at Hope Chapel in Hermosa Beach. That'd be straight west on the 91 freeway, Artesia Boulevard, all the way to the beach, Pacific Coast Highway and Artesia, right there on the corner is Hope Chapel. If you go to our website, str.org, you can get all the information. But that's Fred Sanders tomorrow. Let's go to, we got plenty of room on our lines. I was just going to go to Dan. I will in a second, but I just want to let you know that you can get on too. 1-800-227-5278. And in the 714 area code, 754-4150. If you've been trying to get in and haven't been able to, now's the perfect time. We've got about a half hour to go, and we've got lots of room on the line. So, Dan, welcome to Stand to Reason.
Hi, Greg. Thanks so much.
Sure.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you, I've taken your class at Biola about a year ago now, and I've been trying to reteach that the best I can to college youth groups and things in my church.
On the tactics?
Yeah, tactics, exactly, and it's been something I felt obligated to try in real life as well, so that I know what I'm talking about.
Well, yeah, that's usually a good idea. Try to teach from experience as much as possible.
Exactly, and you also find some little obstacles along the way.
Sure.
And that's what I wanted to call you about. And it's maybe a good segue from the last discussion where you were talking about the tag team approach.
Uh-huh.
I've encountered the problem, and sometimes there's a well-minded Christian involved where you're not just in a one-on-one situation. And there's, whether it's you and other Christians or you're up against an ambush where there's two, three, or more other skeptics.
Uh-huh.
And the tactics I've noticed can be a little bit challenging to employ when you're dealing with people throwing in interjections along the way to
right.
kind of derail you, because you need to have that specific path, or at least have the mind to direct the conversation.
Yeah, you want to focus on a particular thing. It's kind of,
yeah.
if they're giving you a kind of scattergun approach, it's like, you know, when they, I haven't hunted since I was a kid, basically, but, you know, when you hunt quail, a quail is a little bird that breaks up in a covey, right? It just explodes in front of you, and there's like 20 birds at once.
Right.
Amateurs just pull a shotgun up to their shoulder and fire away at the mob, as it were, and hit nothing. And you got to pick out an individual bird if you want to bring one down. That's the kind of the conventional wisdom. And same thing applies here. You got to have a particular thing to talk about.
Right.
And it's hard when the covey explodes in your face, as it were.
That's right. And I'm just wondering if I'm sure you've been in that situation before, and,
mm-hmm.
and you may not even be able to use tactics at all in that situation if it gets too overwhelming. But I'm wondering how you may address that if you tell them I need to talk to you separately or
okay, well, there is a tactic that I have in mind just for this situation. I got to go to break right now, but I'm going to come back and how did we do, what happened? We just lost Dan. Well, Dan, you're in Rancho Santa Margarita, which means you can call me back if you're listening on the air. I don't know what happened. We got to report this to KBRT because this is the second caller we've lost. So my apologies. I'm sure it's at our end. Because you wouldn't hang up on yourself right in the middle of your own sentence. By the way, if you ever want to hang up on somebody else, I've heard the best way to do it is get a word in edgewise and start talking and then push the button, because no one will think that you hung up on yourself. That's why I know Dan didn't do it to himself. So my apologies, Dan. Please try to call back. And when I come back from break, maybe you'll be back on board. And if not, I'll do my best to answer what I understand your question to be. 1-800-227-5278. Dan was the last guy on the line here on Super Bowl Sunday. So spend the next 20 minutes with me. Give me a call, and we'll chat with you about anything that's on your mind in the area of ethics, values, and religion. In the 714 area code, that would be 754-4150 for Stand to Reason.
Tired of walking past that old car, truck, boat, or RV that is rusting or gathering dust in your garage or side yard? Is your neighbor ready to kill you because your car is so ugly? Donate your used vehicle to Stand to Reason today, and you can put that old clunker to work developing training materials that can build a whole new generation of confident, courageous, and winsome ambassadors for Jesus Christ. Think of it. Because of your donation, Christians just like you will be able to effectively share their faith and change the lives of others forever. Simply call us today at 1-877-9-OLD-CAR, and we'll take that vehicle off your hands. We'll even tow it if it won't start and help you with all of the paperwork. You'll receive a tax-deductible receipt for the full market value of your car from Stand to Reason. So, transform your old vehicle into ministry impact to Christians just like you. Give it to Stand to Reason by calling 1-877-9-OLD-CAR. Call 1-877-9-OLD-CAR to help Stand to Reason continue teaching Christians to effectively reach others for Christ. One simple call to 1-877-9-OLD-CAR can change the lives of others forever. Don't wait. Call us today.
We've talked for a long time at STR about the importance of the tactical approach for an ambassador for Jesus Christ. Instead of finding yourself flat-footed and intimidated in conversations about your faith and values, you can increase your confidence and your skill in discussions, no matter who you're talking to, by using sound tactics in defending your faith. But now you can help others learn the material, too, by using the brand-new, unique, interactive training tool, Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. As a group leader, you can help your small group learn specific skills to initiate conversations effortlessly, stop challengers in their tracks and turn the tables, graciously and effectively expose faulty thinking, maneuver through minefields, present the truth clearly, cleverly, and persuasively. Included in the set are 6 one-hour interactive sessions on DVD with discussions, role-playing, self-assessment quizzes, recall exercises, memory tools, games, competition, all to help you learn more effectively. You'll also receive comprehensive leader and student manuals that are included in PDF form for printing and for copying for your group. You'll have everything you need to lead a group to be stronger and better equipped to skillfully present their faith. And it's plug and play. The DVD does all the work. That's Tactics in Defending the Faith Interactive DVD for Small Groups. It's $49.95 and includes 2 DVDs and 1 data CD. Order it at str.org. or call 1-800, the number 2, and the word reason. Greg Kokel giving you a piece of my mind today. I don't trust any of this equipment now. With you every Sunday, 3 to 5. And it looks like we got Dan back on. 1-800-227-5278 is my number. Plenty of room on the lines. In the 714 area code, 754-4150. Dan, I apologize. I don't know what happened, but
no,
you just kind of like went down.
That's okay.
You didn't push any buttons, did you?
No, I wouldn't do that.
I didn't either. Just like you're the second guy that just went away. Like I don't know if you heard me, if you're listening live there in Rancho Santa Margarita, yeah. But I said I didn't think you'd hang up on yourself. So
that's right.
I got a couple of questions for you. Your sure. question is broadly, how do you deal with like a bunch of people who are really pushing you hard and you know, maybe firing a lot of questions at you and ganging up on you and maybe a bunch of skeptics. You mentioned about other Christians. Is part of your question if you and another Christian are sharing with a third party that, you know, how do you get your tactics in line with the other Christian, or maybe they're running off at the mouth too much? Or
I understand what you're saying. I don't mean to confuse the issue, and I just threw that in there because it makes it difficult when there's more than just a one-on-one, I found.
No, you're right about that.
It throws the dynamics off, even if it's another Christian on the same side. But I'd be more interested in the multiple skeptic idea, because in most social situations, when the ideas come up, you may get questions. From
right, right.
Things.
Well, since it's just you and me right now, let me. I'll try to deal with both of them.
Sure.
The first, this thing about the other Christian. This is awkward if you have had some training and kind of a tactical approach. And so you're kind of working your way through an issue and you're trying not to set off the landmines there, and you're trying to be genial and be a good ambassador. And you've got a well-meaning Christian who's making all the wrong moves, and you know it. This is very difficult.
Right.
And because what you don't want to do is turn around and say, would you shut up? You know, I'm trying to handle this guy with kid gloves and you're just trouncing out, because that would be unkind to your other Christian friend. And you might be able to have a conversation and, you know, afterwards, or say, I don't know. It's just awkward. Let's just leave it that way. I've been in the situation and it's hard. Now, sometimes I'm the person in the classroom who's teaching the class. And so I had a person that was like a steamroller, a non-believer that was, you know, blasting me, and other members of the audience were trying to do my job for me. You know, they were jumping in on my behalf, addressing this person that was out of line. And
right.
then I, because I was the head of the class, I was the teacher, I could say, well, you know, I'm a trained professional, I can handle this, you know, settle down. But, you know, when you're just with a buddy, that's a little bit harder. So in that situation, this is where I think the Columbo tactic is very helpful, and also kind of a good cop, bad cop. So if this person, if your buddy, Christian buddy, is coming across too strong or whatever, when you are more genial and gracious and ask questions to draw the other person out, to let them talk, it at least makes you more attractive to them.
Right.
All right. And if your Christian friend is being too aggressive, chances are they are not letting the other person talk, or they're interrupting, and so that's going to frustrate the other. When you ask questions and then they start to talk and your buddy jumps in, you say, hold on just a minute, John, let him finish his comment. I'm really interested to hear what he has to say.
Yeah, I see what you mean. So you take their side for letting them speak.
Yeah, something like that. And so then you try to referee in that way.
Right.
That's the best I can offer you in that
good.
Situation. And later on, then you might want to tell them to go to str.org or
exactly.
your Christian friend, and maybe learn some of these other things. And it's not like we're trying to be haughty, like we know best. But let's face it, there are a lot of Christians have a very awkward way of going about talking about these things that's very off-putting, and we're trying to avoid that as much as possible, as you know. Okay, so let's talk about the second issue. The second issue is when you have a bunch of people coming at you at once. Now, there's a tactic called steamroller tactic. Are you familiar with that tactic?
Yes, the rapid-fire question.
Yeah, the rapid-fire question. So it seems to me that a steamroller, using the steamroller tactic, that is using a tactical approach to deal with somebody who is a steamroller, who fires a bunch of questions and never lets you answer and is constantly interrupting, okay?
Yeah.
That tactic can easily be used, it seems to me, with a small variation, with a group of people who are each firing their own questions, because it turns out to be the same thing. You're being overwhelmed, not by information or expertise, but just by attitude and sheer volume.
Right.
And so classically, when you're dealing with one person there are three steps. I'm sure you know these. The first is you stop them and negotiate very briefly. You might just say, hold on just a minute, I'm not finished. Let me just finish the thought and I'll let you jump in. Is that okay? So there's this little negotiation there because they're interrupting.
Right.
And, you know, half the time that's all it takes. The second step is you shame them. That means you make a very explicit request for courtesy in the conversation.
Yeah.
And if that doesn't work, you leave.
Right, absolutely.
You stop them, you shame them, you leave them, you know, kind of thing. Now, I think you could do the same thing with a group. If there's a whole group ganging up on you, you can try to picture, I'm going to role play it a little bit here. But you got to kind of picture the attitude, which is, again, very genial and warm and like, hey, okay, well, if you got questions, I'm glad to talk to you. I don't mind it's five against one here. But listen, you got to fight me one at a time. Okay, I'll fight you all. That's okay. I'm not afraid of that. You know. So there's a little. It's kind of this like pugilistic kind of metaphor here. This boxing metaphor. But you're joking with it. Okay. But if you come on me all at once, I'm going to go down, and nobody's going to get anywhere.
I mean, right. So you're saying, as a group, you can just still identify each steamroller individually as the problem arises.
Or just say, look, how about if I do this? I want to answer your questions, but if it's just a mob scene, this isn't going to help. Why don't we just deal with one thing at a time? First I'll go with you, and you can ask one thing, and I'll do my best to answer. You know, if it's not adequate, okay, you can judge yourself, but give me a shot. Then the next guy, you got your thing? All right. So you're just trying to referee.
Right.
And you're doing it in a kind of warm-hearted way. You're not saying, come on, you bunch of bums, will you leave me alone? I can't answer everybody at once, and, you know, and bang heads with them, because that just escalates
right,
the situation.
Right, you start with step one.
Yeah, you start with step one. It's you negotiate. And I don't know why you can't do that with a group.
Okay.
Because it's a very – it's a reasonable request.
Sure, sure.
You know, it says what do you want? Do you want an answer?
Right,
okay.
Exactly.
If you want an answer, then give me the question
clearly
so I understand it, and then I'll do my best to answer.
Right.
Now, if you just want to beat me up, and this is in the technique when I in the tactics material, you know, I say part of the way I say it to people is, look, if you just want to talk, I can listen. Go ahead, you talk, and when you're done, let me know, and then we'll be finished with it.
Right.
But if you want to have a question answered, then ask your question, take your time to make it clear to me, whatever, and then once you're done, let me respond, and I'll do my best. So what's it going to be? So that same thing can be done with a group.
Yeah, that makes sense to me.
All right.
I appreciate that, and I'd just like to mention I had Fred Sanders for a couple classes and would endorse your upcoming event.
Oh, good. That's tomorrow night. Yeah, the Master Series at 7 o'clock at Hope Chapel. And, yeah, Fred's a lot of fun. And so he's a guy who can make theology a load of fun.
Yeah, he does it really well.
Yeah, so. Good. Okay, thanks a lot for the call, Dan.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. And I'll get to John here in somewhere in California. It looks like Tecate, but that's like in Mexico. That's a beer. Anyway, we'll get to you in just a moment, but because this is a good opportunity to mention that actually starting on Wednesday night in Conejo Valley, that's out towards Ventura, it's between the San Fernando Valley and Ventura, I will be teaching every Wednesday night this month, starting this Wednesday at 6:45, so it's not 7, it's 6:45 on tactics. I'll be giving a whole course on that, and if this conversation I just had piqued your curiosity at all about dealing with steamrollers, well then this is the place to be. It's a modest cost, $20. That's $5 a night. You get the whole workbook with the tactics course, and I'll be there in person. It won't be my talking head on a DVD. I'll be there to talk to you, train you, teach you these tactics, and answer your questions and how you employ them. And you don't have to know any philosophy or apologetics or theology or anything. You can be a rank beginner. You can be a brand new Christian. That's fine. Because this tactical approach will give you a game plan for thoughtful dialogue with your non-Christian friends, and now's the time to learn it. So just to let you know, if you go to our website at str.org, more information, you can get more information there. Just punch my picture, and then there's a place for my schedule, and that'll come up with the information. I'll be at Living Oaks Church. That's Living Oaks Community Church in Thousand Oaks. Newberry Park. So it's right off the 101 freeway. I mean, it's just right off it. It's about a quarter mile. So it's easy to get to Wednesday night. Hope to see you there. Let's go to John. And let me find your button there, John. And where are you at?
Hello, Greg. Yes, Tecate is right. There's a Tecate, California.
Oh, it
is
Tecate.
A small unincorporated area just north of Tecate, Mexico.
Oh, I got it. Okay. That's one of those border towns.
Exactly.
So Tecate on either side.
That's right.
I think they make the beer on the other side, though, don't they?
Exactly right. That's their claim to fame.
Okay. What's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to respond to the lady who called in earlier regarding Jehovah's Witnesses, regarding something that I do fairly often when I talk with them. And that is, they have this policy that in their own Bible, if the word God is capitalized, it refers to Jehovah.
Mm-hmm.
Otherwise, it refers to a God or a lesser God.
Right, and that's what they do in John 1:1. They
yeah.
just say Jesus was the word was a God,
exactly.
Lowercase. Uh-huh.
But in John 20:28, in their own Bible, New World Translation, you've got Thomas calling Jesus. In their translation, it says, "My Master and my God," and the word God is capitalized there.
Right.
So there, they've got in their own scripture,
right.
Jesus calling Thomas Jehovah.
Yes. Now, that is a good reference. I know a move that they make at that point. I'm curious what they say when you quote that verse.
Well, when I've used it maybe 3 or 4 times, they just don't know what to say. They start fumbling around, and time they just
good.
Said, "Thank you very much," and left.
But they're after, that's like I said, they're going after easier game,
yeah,
you know, because you
right.
know a few things about your scriptures.
Right.
That is a powerful reference, because the only out that I've heard is they're saying, "My Lord," to Jesus, and then they're looking up to the sky and saying, "And my God," you know.
I see, yeah.
But obviously, this is anybody who told me that, I almost want to chuckle good-naturedly, but I want to say, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
Do you think I'm a 3-year-old? You could do that? Give me a break. You don't believe that?
Yeah,
you're too smart to do that. For goodness sake, Thomas is falling down before the resurrected Christ. He's saying, "My Lord," Kyrios. That's Latin, I guess. But anyway, "My Lord and my God." That's Jesus he's falling down before.
Yeah.
For goodness sake.
Yeah, and with a capital G in their own.
Yeah, and they get it, right.
Yeah.
He's talking to Jesus. No, that's a really good point. I'm glad you got in, John. Thanks for that tip.
Thank
Okay, bye-bye. Let's go, Mark. I don't know where you're at, Mark, but I'm glad you got in.
I'm in Ohio, Shreve, Ohio.
Okay, nice to talk to you.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Hey, I have a concern at my church. They're endorsing a pastor from a church in California, and I looked up the church on a website,
mm-hmm.
and they endorse several people or several people that were involved with the Toronto Blessing.
Mm-hmm.
Just wanted to ask you about the Toronto Blessing.
You know, I have not had a call about the so-called Toronto Blessing or the Laughing Revival in years. So I'm glad to respond to it. I didn't even know it was still going.
Well, at least some people that are rolling from it.
Yeah. Well, this was a movement very quickly started in Toronto, and then it spread down to Florida, the Brownsville Revival, alleged revival, and then out here into California, which also in Ontario, Ontario, California, here in the city of Ontario and other places. It was basically people claimed that there was a movement of the spirit where people were moved to fits of laughter. As a result of the Holy Spirit moving on them, and this was evidence of revival, and there were other things that were going on, like later on animal sounds and growling and roaring, and it was bizarre. And this, a lot of people got caught up in this. I wrote a piece called New Move of the Spirit, So What? I won't explain what that means because there's not enough time here, but you can find it on our website. New Move of the Spirit, So What? I would not trust the spiritual wisdom of anybody that was involved in that movement who has not distanced themselves from it. They said I did that. That was kind of a mistake, but I'm disassociating myself from that. Even the Vineyard movement began, John Wimber, I think, began making distancing himself from that whole thing before he died because it was just getting a little goofy. So I just wouldn't have anything to do with that. So if they're offering a pastor who this is part of his credentials, I would not trust the pastor. I mean, this to me is a big red flag for the pastor. It also is a big red flag for those who are advancing this pastor as a credible source of spiritual leadership, if they are impressed with this kind of thing. So maybe this might raise questions from your own church. Now, I don't mean to create a lot of turmoil for you, Mark, but I think this is a big, red flag as far as I'm concerned. I'm sorry we didn't have more time to talk about this. If you want to follow up on it next week, we can talk a little bit more. That's all the time I have for the show, friends. Thank you so much for being a part of our program. And between now and next week, be a good ambassador for Christ. Remember, I'll be at Living Oaks Community Church starting our 4 weeks of tactics teaching on Wednesday. A game plan for thoughtful dialogue with non-Christians. Find out about it on our website. And I'll see you next week, friends. Go out and give them heaven. I'm Greg Kokel for Stand to Reason. Bye-bye.